Fylingdale in Yorkshire. Here, in the event of a nuclear attack, they would count down the 240 seconds to impact, the so-called four-minute early warning. But are the radar defense networks of the world too busy watching each other for signs of madness to detect the presence of a superior intelligence from outer space? Are spacecraft from other worlds already surveying our planet? What are flying saucers, unidentified flying objects, UFOs? Some people say they've seen them in Britain, in Australia, in the Soviet Union, in America. Animal lover Joe Simonton, ex-professional boxer, deputy sheriff, Wisconsin. He showed me the pancake given him by the flying saucer men. These are the two Devon policemen who chased a flying saucer across Dartmoor at 90 miles an hour. Mrs. O'Reilly, one-time BOAC stewardess and poster girl, who saw from a stratocruiser on the approach to Goose Bay, Labrador, in 1954, one of the most puzzling unidentified flying objects ever reported. Barney and Betty Hill, who eventually revealed under hypnosis what happened on the way home from vacation, the most extraordinary flying saucer story of them all.
Now, Mr. and Mrs. Hills, fix your eyes on mine, fix them on mine. Now clasp your hands in front of you, tight, 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 tighter. As they get tighter, you're going to sleep. You're going to a deep, deep sleep. Your eyes are getting heavy. They're closing tight. Now your hands are relaxed. You will relax fully. Relax fully. Your head falls forward. Now you're in a very deep sleep. We're going back. We're going back to September 19, 1961, when you were returning from your vacation. We're going back to September 19, 1961.
In my opinion, the UFO problem is the greatest scientific problem of our times. I think there are essentially four kinds of explanations. First, you might have hoaxes and frauds. Secondly, misidentified objects of terrestrial origin. Third, unusual psychological disturbances of some kind. Fourth, some kind of extraterrestrial vehicles engaged, let's say, in surveying our planet. I go for the fourth one, the idea that objects may be surveying our planet.
My position is that in the UFO, we are actually dealing with extraterrestrial visitation. I say this because people whose judgment you would take under any other circumstances report that they see vehicles, and they report that these vehicles on occasion have occupants.
My interests and qualifications in this matter are primarily anthropological and linguistic, and I translate reports in a dozen languages which come to us from all over the world. And I'm very impressed with the similarities that I find in the experiences that these people claim to have had and in the patterns that I see running through it all. And I simply cannot believe that all these people are nuts.
There is an accumulation of evidence for the existence of flying saucers. And as editor, I see the lot. And this evidence, so we find, goes back for many centuries. I am of the opinion that this thing cries out for a serious scientific investigation.
Yet not one of these men has ever seen a flying saucer. They only take them seriously on the evidence of others.
People who see flying saucers are, generally speaking, distinct from those who believe in them. The believers are so thoroughly wishful in their thinking that they just don't need any personal experience to bolster their faith. But from my point of view, the people who see flying saucers are different. And since only seldom do instruments record flying saucers, it's the people who report seeing them who are the most significant way of getting at the truth. That is why I have long maintained that more good might come from the study of sincere witnesses than from bothering too much about what they say they've seen.
This program is about these sincere witnesses. People like Captain James Howard, senior BOAC pilot, and the only people in this program are the ones I judge to be sincere after going into more than 100 cases. I started my investigation by going aboard of EC-10 and talking to Captain Howard.
Yes, on June the 29th, 1954, I was in command of the BOAC Stratocruiser flight from New York to London. We normally flew non-stop from New York to London, but on this occasion, because the tailwinds were very light, I had to plan to make a refueling stop at Goose Bay in Labrador. We took off from New York at about 5 o'clock in the evening, late afternoon, and climbed out on our track towards Goose Bay. About 3 hours out of New York, we crossed over a place on the St. Lawrence called Seven Islands. At this time, we were flying at 19,000 feet at about 250 miles an hour. And I'm looking out of the left-hand window here. I noticed some moving objects below us and about 3 miles off to our left-hand side. I turned to my co-pilot to attract his attention to them, and he obviously had already seen them. And we looked at these for a few moments, trying to make out what they could be. There appeared to be one large one and a number of small, black, grey objects. And as we watched them, they appeared to be moving with us, moving in and out of the small clouds which were below us at this time. After a few moments, we left all the clouds behind us, and these objects climbed until they were keeping station with us off our port wingtip. It's difficult to estimate the distance, but I should guess somewhere between 2 and 5 miles away. And they stayed there with us for about 20 minutes in all. And while they were traveling alongside us, I had a sketch pad on my knee, and I was able to make sketches of the appearance of these things, whatever they were. In short, there were six small ones, which were roughly globular in shape, and one large one, which slowly but continually changed its shape. On one occasion, it looked rather like a dumbbell, or at the time I said it looked like an upturned telephone receiver lying on its side. Another time, it looked rather like an arrowhead, and then it merged from that into a globular shape again. It was dark in color, and although silhouetted against a fairly bright evening sky, it was absolutely opaque. And by this time, of course, the rest of the crew, the navigator, radio officer, flight engineer, and so on, had cottoned on that something very peculiar was going on, and they were all crowding around the windows and watching this thing. I turned to the co-pilot and said, I think we ought to tell somebody that there's something very strange going on. And he said, yes, but what shall I tell them? I couldn't think of what to say, so I said, ask Goose Bay Radio if they have any other traffic in this area. And he did that, and they said, no, we haven't. Why do you want to know? So then he had to describe what we saw. And then, after a moment or so, the controller at Goose Bay said that he had a night fighter, an Air Force machine, in the vicinity of Goose Bay, and would send it down in our direction to see if he can have a look, which he did. And after about another 5 minutes or so, the instruction came from the ground to change radio frequency so that I could talk directly to the fighter pilot. And I described what I saw to this fighter, and he began narrowing the distance between us. But as I was talking to the fighter pilot, the small objects, disappeared. I didn't personally see them disappear, but my navigator told me that the small ones went towards the center one and appeared to go into it and leave only the large one visible. And as I was watching again, the large object appeared to shrink in size until it was no more than a pinpoint height. And this was the way it was when the fighter arrived overhead.
Did anyone else see these things, apart from the people on the flight deck with you?
Yes, after we'd been watching these things for a few minutes, the stewardess came up from the passenger cabin to say that the passengers were all watching these objects and wanted to know what they were. And she said, by the way, what are they? And of course, we weren't able to enlighten her very much.
And the stewardess was Mrs. O'Reilly, then Miss Daphne Webster.
After we'd served dinner to the passengers, we were serving drinks, and we noticed there was some confusion in the cabin. Passengers were all looking out of the port side of the aircraft. I went to look through to see what was going on, looked through the window, and there we saw these seven objects. specifically one very large one, which was black and solid looking. It kept changing shape. When we first saw it, it was pear-shaped, and then it was stretched out like a cigar, and then like an inverted telephone. I know it sounds ridiculous, but it did look absolutely solid. There were six little ones flying in formation, sometimes three in front and three behind, or five in front and one behind, but always six, but changing formation. The passengers, of course, asked me what it was, and I had no idea. And I went onto the flight deck and asked Captain Howard. When I got onto the flight deck, Captain Howard and the technical crew were also all looking through the window. And when I asked Captain Howard what it was, he simply said, "Well, I don't know, but for goodness sake, keep the passengers happy."
What did you personally feel when you saw them?
It's rather odd, this, because I felt rather kindly disposed towards them, if you like. People have often asked me whether we were in any sense afraid of them or whether we felt they were hostile, and the answer is exactly the opposite. I talked with my crew later about this, and all of them agreed that they felt some sort of bond of affection, if you like, between us and them, whatever they were. And this was very strange. A very powerful feeling, too, and a thing that I remember to this day.
Would you describe the feeling as comforting?
Yes, indeed. That does sum it up. And when the things disappeared, we felt almost a sense of loss, disappointment that they'd gone.
Throughout an investigation of this kind, we have to remember that everyone is only human, scientists and BOAC pilots alike. So why should Captain Howard find it so comforting? Was this, after all, a wish fulfillment of some kind? But then, a plane load of people, and as far as I can find out, they all shared the experience. This really is a most puzzling case. Then, much more recently, in October 1967, there were the two Devon policemen, Roger Willie and Clifford Waycott, who seemed to start a spate of sightings over Britain which hit the headlines for weeks on end. First with the news was the local reporter, Jack Hellier.
Police in a patrol car chased two large, cross-shaped, unidentified flying objects for nearly an hour through Devon today. The objects...
The demonstration...
That evening, it made the news on the BBC.
Delegations coming mostly from the Midlands and the Northeast. Devon's unidentified flying object, the two policemen who chased it in their car near Okehampton early today, said later they're certain it wasn't an aircraft or a planet. They watched the object, a bright light in the shape of a cross, for nearly an hour.
It looked like a bright street lamp.
Was it high or was it low in the sky?
It was at treetop height.
Was it making a noise?
No.
For how long did you follow it?
We followed it for... at that time, for a while, but then later, in all, the time we followed it was for about 50 minutes.
How about speed? What speed was it doing?
I would say the acceleration was really terrific, between 90 and 100 miles an hour.
Did it look to you as if it was under control, being piloted by somebody?
It looked to me that it was under control, but whether or not it was piloted is beyond me.
Next morning, it was on the front page of the Times, and by evening it ran across five columns of the Evening Standard.
A pound to a penny it was Venus, suggested the Royal Observatory at Hurstmonceux. The flying crosses seen by police in Devon, Dorset and Sussex were U.S. Air Force planes on a refueling exercise, a Ministry of Defense spokesman said last night. The Royal Observatory said, there is something up there which is not a star or a planet. The Ministry of Defense admitted yesterday that the emphatic and official explanation given on Friday no longer stands up.
What has been your reaction to it since you actually saw it some months ago now?
Well, we haven't deviated from what we first said.
What about the explanations which have been offered in the press and elsewhere?
I give no credence to them.
You, Roger?
I think if somebody could give us some good logical explanation for what it was, then probably you might be able to accept it.
Things are sent from this world into outer space, and there should be a rational explanation of where they end up. Sometimes there is no rational explanation. And I've had ordinary people say to me, well, it's obvious, you know, that if we send stuff up there, that they can send stuff down to us. It's not beyond the realms of possibility, either, I don't think.
Has it ever occurred to you that what you saw might be something that you saw all right, but it wasn't there at all?
Well, I think if I observed it on my own, probably, yes, it might have been, but seeing that my colleague also observed it, other people that saw it previous to the time that we saw it, completely independent.
There was a telephone message on my inspector's desk which he showed me from a lady who lived near where we'd first seen it. And apparently her 15-year-old son had the flu, and she was in his bedroom, and they were both awake when she looked out of the window, and she is alleged to have said, "Ye God's boy, the Martians are coming."
But throughout the chase, squad car crews all over Devon and Cornwall were in fact pulling their legs over the intercom. But not one of the other crews saw anything strange in the sky. Now, Venus rose that morning at 3:20 in the eastern sky, and by 5 o'clock would have been just above treetop height. But then I've checked with the Met Office, and they report the sky completely overcast. However, it remains a fact that no single object has been misinterpreted more often than the planet Venus. But it certainly wasn't Venus that Dr. Clyde Tombaugh saw. He's the astronomer who discovered the planet Pluto and now works in Las Cruces, New Mexico.
Well, of the three different types of objects that I have seen, I would say the most extraordinary one was one I saw in 1949 in August in Las Cruces from my backyard. On that particular evening, my wife and her mother and I were enjoying the cool air, and I was admiring the beautiful transparent sky with the stars, and I happened to be looking overhead, and suddenly I spied a strange group of lights moving. And I said, "Look." And they saw it immediately, and then I would say they were visible for about 3 seconds of time. And they disappeared at a height of about 35 degrees above the south-southeastern horizon. No sound, and they seemed to kind of pale out. The rectangles of feeble light seemed to foreshorten into slits. And I've never seen anything like it before or since, and I'm very much puzzled as to what the thing was.
Of course, the stars were always there, but not balloons. And an awful lot of UFOs turn out to be meteorological balloons. But surely not the one Professor Charles Moore saw. He is professor of physics at the Institute of Mining and Technology in New Mexico.
In 1949, I was working with the Navy balloon project and made a number of pilot balloon wind measurements. We launched a balloon one Sunday morning here in New Mexico in the company of some Navy enlisted men. One of the Navy enlisted men had never seen this before and was using the theodolite to follow the balloon. And after a little while, I looked up to see how he was doing. And I saw an object that I thought was a balloon that was moving into the east quite rapidly, and I urged that he get back on the balloon, and he assured me he had the balloon. So I immediately took the theodolite, looked through it, and he did have the balloon. I was very interested in what this other object was, so I abandoned the balloon and began tracking it. It was moving very rapidly, about 5 degrees or so per second, across the sky, went all the way from the southwest down into the northeast, and then it increased in elevation angle and got small in a hurry. It did all this in about 65 seconds. We were quite puzzled about this, so we made another sounding. I released another balloon and followed it this time to 90,000 feet. And this balloon went into the south. It had a north wind at all altitudes from the surface up to 90,000 feet. Yet this object that I had thought initially was the balloon moved against the wind. So I knew this wasn't a balloon, it wasn't a bird, and it wasn't Venus. I went over and called the White Sands Missile Range blockhouse to find out if they had launched something. and I got some message back to the effect that, are you guys nuts? This is Sunday. Nobody's working.
Meteorological balloons, refueling aircraft, and optical instruments that sometimes produce ghost images are comparatively recent. But the UFO mystery is probably as old as man himself.
Legends tell of a time when men from the skies landed on our planet. Are these prehistoric rock carvings their pictures? This fresco, the great Martian god, dates back to 6,000 BC. It was discovered in caves in the Sahara. The strange headgear closely resembles that of a modern astronaut. Early history contains descriptions of inexplicable sights in the sky, and the classic UFO description is always there. Moving lights, glowing disks, or cigar-shaped objects. These were interpreted as natural phenomena and were drawn in ways understandable to the people of the time. Where we might now draw a spacecraft, here they drew cannon shot. But what did the people of the time make of this fresco, now in a Yugoslav monastery? Despite its apparent modern idiom, it dates back to the 14th century. Denison, Texas, Friday, January the 25th, 1878. A farmer saw a strange phenomenon flying at incredible speed. He described it as a large saucer. In 1897 came the first wave of flying saucer reports. A strange flying machine was seen over the Midwest of America. It was watched by thousands of onlookers, and in Kansas, it's said to have snatched a cow from a terrified farmer. The machine was reported to fly at 150 miles an hour. This seemed incredible, and could only be explained by the discovery of a new force. This is an engraving of a spacecraft with searchlights, which appeared over San Francisco in 1896. 12 years later, a similar craft appeared over Peterborough in England and was seen by a policeman. This started another wave of reports.
But it was in 1947 that the major waves began, with peaks in 52, 57, and the last 3 years. These are American Air Force figures. 695 remain unexplained. But why the increase since 1947?
One of the characteristics of all belief systems is that once the original premise is accepted, the argument follows quite logically.
Mr. John Jackson, Senior Lecturer in Sociology, University of East Anglia.
The development of spiritualism at the end of the 19th century may partly be explained by the failure of the church to answer fundamental questions in a way that would satisfy an increasingly scientific viewpoint. The spiritualists claimed to provide evidence which resolved the uncertainty. In such situations where problems of the unknown, whether they are life after death or the existence of life on other planets are concerned, people who are anxious may find that the conventional wisdom of religion or of science may lack sufficient and satisfactory answers. Instead, they turn to those who appear to be able to provide certainty to resolve their doubts. It could therefore be argued that the present interest in aerial phenomena, and especially UFOs, like 19th century spiritualism, is the result of a feeling of betrayal. To this must be added the very considerable feeling that people have of the destructive forces of science itself. It's significant that some people believe that flying saucers are sent to absorb the harmful effects of atomic radiation and to save us from destroying ourselves.
Not everyone, however, and not everyone finds flying saucers comforting.
I saw these flames coming from the bottom, raced up about 20, 30 feet, and just stayed there. That's when I ran back up here to hide.
This is Lonnie Zamora, who was a patrolman in the city police force, Socorro, New Mexico. He saw his UFO on April the 24th, 1964. This amazing story starts here. Police headquarters in Socorro are in the courthouse, and when Patrolman Zamora came out late that afternoon, he heard a speedster with loud exhausts and gave chase on Park Street, going south.
He was doing better than 60 right here.
Small-town style, Zamora recognized the black Chevy ahead and knew the young driver. And when he forked right on this dirt road, Zamora knew there was no need to chase further. There's a dead end up there.
And I stopped right about here. That's where I heard this big sound, this boom. Looked up there and I saw some dust flying. And I figured that the dynamite check might have blown up or something. So I started up again on this road here. Real fast.
When he got to the top of the slope, through the dust and smoke, he could see two white figures and a white object, which he took to be an overturned car. Though thinking somebody might be trapped, he speeded up.
Called the office, and I was going to get out of the car.
But when he got there, the figures had gone, and down in the gully, right there, he saw a large, white, round object standing on four legs with flames roaring out from underneath it, and he was very frightened.
What were you frightened of?
Of the flames coming from under it. I thought it was going to blow up.
So, what happened then?
Then it raced up about 20, 30 feet, and it stayed there for a while, and then it took off that way right there, up on top of the dynamite check, real low, and up those mountains up there.
Since then, this little patch on the prairie of New Mexico has become almost a shrine, with the landing pad marks of Zamora's flying saucer preserved with little rings of stone.
Looking back on it now, Mr. Zamora, what happened after this object went away over the mountains?
I came back to the police car from where I was hiding. Afterwards, Sergeant Chavez came in his car. We looked down there, and this bush was burning yet. And we was going to go down there, and he said, we better wait until it quiets down.
Why? What quiet down?
Well, excitement, I guess. And he said not to go down there, he might be radioactive. So he radioed into the courthouse, told him to get a hold of the Army. He did. About 5-10 minutes later, Captain Holder and a sergeant came up there with a box, a Geiger counter, I guess. And they went down there to trace this, I guess. He said he was, afterwards, about 5 minutes later, he said to come down. It was clear. So we went down there to investigate.
And what did you see?
We saw four imprints in the ground.
In my judgment, Lonnie Zamora is not lying, in the sense that he consciously believes he saw what he says he saw. What's more, at Whiting Brothers gas station, somebody else is reported to have seen it too, a passing motorist. So I called in there for petrol and asked the manager, Opal Grinder, what the motorist told him.
Well, that tourist came up here and loaded gasoline. He'd come from the south, and he said, your aircraft around here flies awfully low. I said, well, how was that, sir? He said, well, it would like to knock me off the road out there. He said, it must have been in trouble. He said, a policeman was going to it. So I asked him, was it a helicopter? He said, no. He said, if it was, it's a funny-looking one. So he went on about his affairs, and I was making up the bank deposits for the bank at 15 to 6, and that was the same time he was here. And the next morning, well, it dawned on me that at the time they all met was the same time that the tourist was in here, that Zamora went to that object that was on the ground there. And I called the radio station and told him Zamora was not telling a lie because the tourist seen something and didn't think much of it. And he saw the policeman also going to the object that was on the ground, which was a UFO.
Well, Mr. Zamora's story is certainly one of the most interesting cases we've had.
To me, the whole thing illustrates a neurotic element surrounding these things. Mr. Zamora says that Sergeant Chavez told him not to go down in the gully in case of radioactivity. And when an officer arrived from the Army, an intelligence officer, he went down into the gully with a Geiger counter. Why should he be looking for radioactivity? What has it got to do with it?
Well, it's sort of the thing to do. I don't think it's relevant to the case. I'm naturally interested in the basic question. I always try to ask myself, did anything really untoward happen? And whether they were looking for beetles or for radioactivity or microbes, it would make very little difference to me. The something apparently happened there. I want to know what was it, and what credibility can I assign to that thing? For instance, on the hypothesis that some people have indicated that the thing might have been a hoax. Well, good hoaxes don't keep. After a few years, what's the point of a hoax if you can't tell somebody about it, that you put something over, and it hasn't leaked? I mean, I can't. Furthermore, if some of the local people, particularly students, had wanted to get even with Zamora, they wouldn't have concocted anything so elaborate, fantastically elaborate thing. They would have simply slashed his tires or done something much more overt and strangely American.
Do you think Zamora in fact saw something?
Well, I'm sure that he thinks he saw something. There's just no question about that in my mind. I don't think he's a liar. But remember that in all these flying saucer incidents, until we have an absolutely incontrovertible photograph that we can say this is a real photograph, there's just simply no question about it. We do not even know that there was an image on Zamora's retina of his eye when he said he saw that, you see. I've visited Socorro a number of times, trying, frankly, to break down the man's character, try to find out whether he's capable of a hoax and whether what his reputation is like. And I've inquired of people who have known him all his life, and even the parents of some of my students happen to live in Socorro, and I roundabout tried that. And Zamora has always held up. His character has simply held up as a solid American citizen cop.
But Zamora, you notice, is no longer a cop. He now works at a gas station, sometimes serving former colleagues. If there's wish fulfillment in seeing flying saucers, apparently it doesn't always pay off. They doubt your word, check your character. There's not only a neurotic element here, they can all get pretty paranoid as well.
If I ever dealt with people like I did, Mr., you would have it up to here.
Joe Simonton lives more than 1,000 miles north of Zamora, way up in Wisconsin. He's the animal lover, ex-professional boxer and deputy sheriff, who had the pancakes from the little men in the flying saucer, which landed right here in his driveway.
It was right about that black spot right there.
Right here.
Yeah, yeah. And there were three men in there. One was making conversations by signs to me. Nobody spoke a word. And one was cooking these pancakes, and one was sitting at a control panel. As I walked over to this thing, this man... pancake that I have left, and it's got holes clear through it. I'm going to turn it around so you can see the whole thing, and it's just as thick as it now as it was when I got it. And that's what I got from the flying saucer men. I got four of them, and that's the only one I have left, and that's for my own security. I wouldn't take no money, nothing, for this little pancake.
Do you think Joe Simonton is lying? I don't, and the United States Air Force took him seriously enough to analyze one of his pancakes. Psychology aside, is a flying saucer an aerodynamic possibility? Remember, they were invented, so to speak, long before flying machines. Mr. Brian Winder is an engineer graduate of Leeds University. He's addressing a joint meeting of the British Interplanetary Society and Royal Aeronautical Society at Bristol. These are the men who built Concorde.
In a conventional jet engine of the type that you're building for Concorde, for example, the whole of the propellant air passes through the engine. Now, in a pulsed hydromagnetic system of this kind, the propellant air flows almost entirely outside the engine. The neutral air, which is unaffected by the magnetic field, flows in across it until it's under the machine. Then the thermonuclear reactor, which is essential for this kind of propulsion because it has such a high power-to-weight ratio and because it will also produce the ideal ionizing radiation for dealing with the air, flushes this air and ionizes it. The air is then trapped by the magnetic field. Can't escape across the field, but can escape parallel to the field. The field pulses and expels that air, thus creating a very large jet compared with the size of the engine producing it. This gives rise to remarkable propulsion capabilities. For example, as these figures show, if the system is pulsed about three times in every 2 seconds, it can literally drive a machine weighing 1,000 tons upwards at an acceleration of 30 G, 30 times the acceleration due to gravity. Now, how would a machine of this kind appear to a casual observer? The jet velocities are low, and therefore the jet is much more silent than a conventional jet. The ionization produces glows that are almost always described by human beings as weird. They are typically the greens and reds of ionized oxygen, or at higher power levels, the violets of ionized nitrogen in the air. And I would like to show you a picture which may illustrate this effect. This photograph was taken by two young ladies in Southern Ireland. On a very bright sunny afternoon, they saw this small, luminous, round object moving across the sky from right to left in front of them. They insist that they did not see this great, bright plume behind it. Now, the only thing, of course, that will affect a film and yet be invisible to the eye is an ultraviolet image. Now, ionized air has several other properties. It's electrically conductive and can interfere with high-tension electrical equipment, for example, with the sparking plug of a vehicle. It also smells because it contains large quantities of ozone, and the smell would be described by a nearby observer as unpleasant and acrid.
Well, it was a smell. It was a smell that someone has asked me if it was smelled like ozone, but I don't know what the smell of ozone is. And the only way that I could describe it is the smell of Bakelite, which is under friction, being bumped up, and it sends up a distinctive smell, more like insulation.
Now, that wouldn't have been anything to do with the engine, which had stalled.
No, because this is all PVC encased wire through here, and the smell is completely different.
On Thursday, October the 26th, 1967, just after the Devon police sightings, you may notice, Mr. Collett was driving a load of titanium along the A32 near Hook, Hampshire, on his way from Crawley to Redditch. Approaching the A30, his vehicle stalled and his lights went out.
And it wasn't until I sort of put the bonnet down and I turned away that I saw it in the sky. But the actual feeling, the pressure that was on my eardrums, was actually before I'd seen it.
The only other physical thing I noticed is that I lost a sense of coordination between my foot and my hand. I noticed that I had a pulsation through the fingertips here, and it was like having a separate pulse on each finger. I turned around to get into the motor, and I saw this object in the sky there, about 100 yards away, about 50 to 100 foot in the air, and I should say at least 60 foot across. It covered the entire width of the road, because as I looked up, it was one side of the trees and the other side of the trees, as far as I could see it. That was it.
It's part of the flying saucer mythology that they settle over power lines to recharge their batteries. But on this occasion, the electricity board reported no unusual demand, and it was 4:30 in the morning. What's more, radar defense did not detect any unusual object that night, and at Filingdale's they could locate a barn door over Siberia. But are they being fooled in their multi-million pound James Bond world? Missiles aside, there's an elaborate radar defense network against conventional aircraft. One of them is at Bordsey in East Anglia. I asked Wing Commander Mason, could a spacecraft enter British airspace and remain undetected?
Any flying object which has a reflecting surface, and I know of none that haven't, once it enters the radar cover over the United Kingdom, would be reported as an unidentified track. The whole country is covered by a complete overlapping radar system. And it is the job of this radar network as a whole to report all tracks and identify them. If a track appears on the radar screens, it's our job to identify this through our communications network. At any time, we can pick out any track. And if it is of significance, we can continue to track this until such time as action is taken or until it's disregarded. And if need be, we can scramble aircraft to identify. During the whole process of radar scanning, the radar is filmed continuously. At any time, we can refer back to these films to investigate and examine any reported tracks. A considerable amount of our time is being taken up by investigating so-called UFO reports, all which have proved absolutely fruitless.
And besides military radar, there is civil control of airlines. In Boston, I checked with the Federal Aviation Agency. This unit controls all flights over New York and points north.
He'll be holding to 1 hour.
This is what Traffic Supervisor O'Brien said when I asked him if he'd ever checked UFO reports.
Well, the cases that we've had where we got the report soon enough to confirm or to go to the scope to confirm the report, we have never seen a UFO or a reported UFO on the scope.
Nevertheless, the U.S. Air Force has allocated $500,000 for flying saucer research and set up a study group at Denver, Colorado, to investigate the whole phenomenon. The chairman is Dr. Edward Condon, a physicist of international repute and an independent-minded man who showed great courage during the McCarthy witch hunts. So, can you investigate UFOs scientifically?
Well, I think so, but it's very, very difficult. Of course, scientifically merely means to collect as much good, careful data as one can and to examine it and interpret it as rationally as one can. The difficulties are that the phenomena are really quite rare and very much diluted by a lot of reports that are really have commonplace explanations. But then having gotten to the few rare ones, one has to work on them. But the great difficulty, I would say, the greatest that's from a physicist's point of view, is that the phenomena only last a very short time, and most people are slow about reporting, so we don't hear about it till the next day. So the difficulty of it makes it hard for us to take pictures or spectra or any of those things that a physicist would like to do. We're just reduced to talking to people, and that's not very satisfactory to a physicist.
And people, of course, are biology, which is much more complicated than physics. They can deliberately perpetrate fakes. And with the high prices paid for flying saucer photographs, there's money in it, too, and a lot of fun. The BBC Special Effects Department certainly enjoyed making this piece of film, shown at the beginning. But sometimes people make genuine mistakes. In this very aircraft, Mrs. Oldfield left Manchester. While filming clouds, she saw a strange object swim into view. The BBC programme Tomorrow's World investigated.
The thing was cigar-shaped and blue-grey in colour. Suddenly it vanished, seeming to turn on its axis and shoot off into the distance. Here's that sequence again, slowed down. If we look at the disappearing act frame by frame, we can see that the actual disappearance is completed in the course of only three frames. Assuming the object to be about 40 feet long, as the faint appearance of portholes along the sides suggest, it must have accelerated away at a speed of something like 5,000 miles an hour, seven times the speed of sound, in only 1/16 of a second. No wonder no one else on board saw it. This is a British United Airways Dart Herald. The registration number, Golf Alpha Papa Whiskey India, shows it to be the very plane Mrs. Oldfield flew in. Notice the tailplane. It was this that suggested the flight might prove worthwhile. Our cameraman sat in the same seat as Mrs. Oldfield had. Through the window, notice how the view is distorted at the edges. The glass is slightly convex where it meets the frame. Taxiing out now for the takeoff. A 16mm camera is unwieldy, and for hunting UFOs, perhaps less effective than the amateur's 8mm. Nevertheless, watch very carefully. Here it comes. Tomorrow's world's very own UFO. This is how Mrs. Oldfield described her experience. I looked out of the window and saw what I thought to be some kind of large aircraft cutting obliquely across the back of our aircraft. It was smooth, but not shiny or glittering. It was clearly defined. What we are seeing now is, in fact, a direct view of the tailplane of the aircraft, seen at an acute angle to the window glass. At the edge of the windows, the angle of the glass changes, breaking the image and making it seem to float disembodied in space. Those portholes on the UFO are, in fact, flaking paint on the leading edge of the tailplane. A slight change of camera angle makes the UFO disappear or reappear.
So, however sincere a witness may be, it's no use judging the evidence on their sincerity. Some of the most controversial photographs ever taken were by this man, Rex Heflin, traffic investigator of Orange County, Southern California. On a routine tour, he took this photograph, and this one, and this. And in particular, this photograph of a deposit in the sky as the saucer disappeared. And it all happened on this very stretch of road near the Santa Ana Freeway.
What I'm trying to do is see whether an individual could drive up in a van and suspend a model like this from the top of the van, and then get in and photograph it, all without arousing too much curiosity, and get pictures like Mr. Heflin got.
Dr. William Hartman is an astronomer in the University of Arizona. He's responsible to the Condon Study Group at Denver, Colorado, for the investigation of all photographic evidence.
To let it dry off a little bit before we can peel the backing off of it. What we get is a pretty good duplication of the Santa Ana photograph. It's sharp, and it looks pretty much like what they had.
It's fantastic, this
thing. The trouble, we thought that we couldn't do it that way originally because we thought that it would be too close to the camera, the little model. And we thought the model would be fuzzy and the background would be sharp. But this camera that he used turns out to have a great depth of field, keeps everything sharp, and turns it out to look quite a bit like the original. It's not saying that he did it that way, but anyone else can argue that he did it that way, and that means it doesn't have as much value to the scientist.
Yeah, well, as a result of this kind of experimentation, Doctor, what is your view as to the validity, then, of photographic evidence in these flying saucer investigations?
You keep coming back to the problem of what does an individual case do to help establish that there really are UFOs flying through our atmosphere, some kind of solid, extraordinary object. And if a single case can be easily duplicated this way, then anyone who chooses not to believe the idea of UFOs has an easy way out. So you've got to have a case that pretty well stands up. And usually this means multiple witnesses, photographs that really indicate, have evidence that indicate that something solid was there, something large and extraordinary. You have exactly the same kind of thing in the assassination of President Kennedy, for example. You've got eyewitnesses, you've got photographs,
You've got hard evidence, bullets, fragments of things. And yet, there's a big question, and people argue both ways, and people write books that one thing happened and another thing happened. In this problem of UFOs, we have exactly the situation you would expect if there were objects seen. A lot of confusion, people are giving contradictory testimony. I don't think there's anything in the evidence that we have that's inconsistent with the idea that UFOs pass over. That doesn't prove that they do.
Mr. Heflin, how do you feel to be the subject of a scientific investigation which is virtually an estimation of your integrity?
Well, I feel fine. My particular line of work is investigation of conditions, people, things, and I have no ill feeling whatsoever about a thorough investigation.
You see, Dr. Hartman's made the point that the whole scientific integrity of this thing turns on the fact as to whether it is easy or not to fake photographs of this kind.
I understand that. I personally do not know how easily one could be faked. However, this day and age, we're in close proximity to production areas that can produce anything one would desire on film, right up 35 miles from here in Hollywood. And evidence of that is such that you're familiar with Bambi and Snow White and Mary Poppins.
Yes, I am. Take the fourth picture. Now, there is cloud cover in that, but not in the other pictures. How do you account for that?
Well, I feel it was up. It was caused with the electronic circuit in the camera and the change in the shutter. When one would photograph a photo from within a vehicle or a building to the outside, you lose the definition of your sky or cloud marking. But as soon as one goes out in the surrounding light, and which I did to photograph that, stepped out of the vehicle, immediately your lens will recover and show more detail.
Mr. Heflin, this isn't a snide question. The implications are obvious. But are you a man who has ever or does, in fact, make models?
Oh, yes. Probably since I was 10 years old, I have constructed and flown model aircraft. And if the time permitted, I would be doing it yet. I just don't have the time for it. I think it's a wonderful hobby.
Yes, Mr. Heflin is a model man. His collection of trains is one of the finest in the United States, worth nearly £10,000. And, of course, he does make models. But we have to face the fact, such is the nature of the human mind, that it is possible for someone to fake a photograph and forget it. Indeed, people can even see flying saucers and forget it. On the night of the 19th of September, 1961, Barney and Betty Hill were returning from a second honeymoon. They were on their way home to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. They remembered leaving a restaurant here about 10 o'clock that night and heading south down Route 3. And then, at about this point, an extraordinary series of events began.
Betty called my attention to something that she'd been observing in the sky. It was a star, and she saw it as a stationary object. When I looked, it was now beginning to move. When I looked again to see where the object was, it had descended to about 200 feet from the ground. I became at this time determined that I was going to identify this as something natural because I didn't believe in UFOs or flying saucers, any of that nonsense.
But the next thing the Hills could remember afterwards was driving along this stretch of road. Where had they been? What had happened in between? This remained a mystery for several years until Dr. Benjamin Simon, the leading psychiatrist in Boston, hypnotized the Hills separately and took them back in time to that extraordinary night.
We both described under hypnosis of the car coming to a complete halt, the electrical system dying out, a cluster of men on the highway coming toward us. Three came up on my side, several on Betty's side. Of course, she tells this part much better than I could because this would have been her experience.
When this happened, I became terrified. And I thought, well, I'll get out of the car and I'll run and hide in the woods. Just as I opened the car door, the men opened it for me and stepped close to where I was. One man put his hand out, and I suddenly had the feeling of going to sleep. And then for a while, I didn't know quite what happened. The man beside me said that I had no reason to be afraid. They just wanted to do a few simple tests. Then they would take us back to the car, and we could be on our way home. In spite of this, I preferred not to go on board, but he was very insistent and authoritarian about this, and Barney was of no help. He was sleepwalking. So we went on board. First, they took Barney into one room, and I went into a second room. In this room, they did what I would call a fairly simple physical examination. They seemed to have mostly interest in my skin. I had the idea they were taking pictures of my skin. Also, interest in my hands and my feet. They also did a test which they called checking my nervous system. Also, there was another examination where they tried to insert an instrument, needle-like instrument, just below my navel. And this caused pain. The leader, the one I call the leader, put his hand out over my eyes. The pain went away. But they seemed to be show emotion about this as though they were sorry that they had hurt me. Only they, I would say, throughout the whole examination, it would be like picking up some kind of a strange animal and looking it over, giving it a checkup and putting it back down again without any intentions of harming it. But not really too important whether they did or not. After the examination, I was waiting because they had not completed Barney's. And this man, whom I call the leader, was standing there. I said to him, "This is an extraordinary experience. No one is ever going to believe this has happened. What I need is some proof, some evidence." So he told me to look around. What would I like to take? On this table, there was a huge book, or quite a large book. So he said I could have this. And I was delighted with this. Then one of the men came running into the room and was pulling at my teeth. And they were quite amazed. And I noticed that he had Barney's dentures in his hand. And this seemed to be quite interesting to them on why his teeth were removable and mine were not. After this conversation, the men came out bringing Barney. And the leader said we could now go back to the car. I was very, very relieved. And I picked up the book he had given me. Barney was ahead, and I was following behind when all of a sudden there seemed to be some kind of discord. The leader stopped and went back to where this group of men was standing, whom I call the crew members. He came back and he took the book. And I was very angry about this because this was my proof. And he said, well, this was the purpose of taking the book, that he himself had no objections to my having it, but the others did, and that they had as much right in this decision as he did. And they had decided that we were going to forget the whole experience.
Dr. Simon, what do you make of the Hill's extraordinary story?
Well, it was at the very least puzzling. They both gave the same story of their experience in the sighting of an unidentified flying object, adding to it, as I had directed under hypnosis, their emotional experiences during this. However, Betty went on to recount a fantastic story of the return of the vehicle, the emergence of the men from the vehicle, and their abduction of Barney and Betty. Betty described in great detail her examinations with such things as a needle in the navel, and there were a lot of other incongruities in time and space that she gave. This left me baffled, and I was at considerable loss until I realized that a positive quality of all these things was its dream quality, that dreams are the areas in which these things can exist together, be acceptable, and not require a diagnosis of mental disorder or anything else of that sort. This led to an original problem. Had been nightmares, which in part was a dream. The next question was how it got to Barney. She denied telling him. He denied being told. She did admit telling the dreams to her supervisor and her sister, and it turned out that Barney at the time was on night duty, was working nights, and therefore was home in the daytime. And finally, I found that she had told these dreams in Barney's presence, though it was not recognized by the two. Therefore, he could understand a part of the story. Now, the suggestion by the supervisor that these might not be dreams, but a reality, was apparently followed by the complete repression of the whole thing, leading to what we might call this amnesia, or this gap in memory, which opened up under hypnosis, producing this fantastic story.
Dr. Simon, are Mr. and Mrs. Hill deep trance hypnotic subjects?
They are. They hypnotize very easily. They show spontaneous amnesia and could be taken back in time.
I find that answer, that the Hills are deep trance hypnotic subjects, very significant. I'll explain why in a moment. Because that was virtually the end of my investigation, except for a short consultation with a computer. As I see it, there is certainly something very interesting going on. And I should like to make 3 points. In the first place, as a research worker in neurophysiology, it naturally occurred to me that a lot of apparent movement of lights in the sky might be due to a well-known mechanism in the brain which makes a flickering light in a darkened room appear to move. It's unlikely to move for you on television because total darkness is required, or so it's believed. But for this girl, the light seems to move, and she is following the apparent movement with the joystick, and her subjective experience, the way she thinks she sees the light move, is recorded here. Barney said himself he didn't believe in UFOs, flying saucers, or any of that nonsense, but Betty did. She told me so herself. So that, to some extent, suggestion was going on in the home. Could a flickering light then, and the way people react in grooves and hypnosis all combined, explain flying saucers? Well, certainly not all of them, but perhaps some. But what sort of group behavior was going on in Captain Howard's plane with the crew separated from the passengers? It all gets a bit spooky and implies telepathy or something, unless, of course, those UFOs were really there. In any case, what about this? 2,500 miles away on that very same day, the old Gaumont British News reports.
In June 1954, a flight was made by a party of Scandinavian cameramen and astronomers for the purpose of filming the total eclipse of the sun. This is a factual account of what happened during that scientific mission 3 miles above the Earth. While the plane was timing to gain the scheduled height of 15,000 feet, the passengers were busy assembling and checking their instruments. While some filmed the eclipse with its fiery corona, others were making detailed notes of the amazing phenomenon. Then, while they were returning to base, one member spotted moving objects. The chief cameraman quickly prepared his camera and filmed them for about 10 seconds before they disappeared. These are the actual pictures he took. 2 shiny discs moving away in the top left-hand corner were calculated to be 15 or 20 miles away, which would suggest they were of enormous size. These pictures, taken with a miniature camera, have been enlarged, thus magnifying the blemishes on the negative. And now the objects are enlarged up even further. There were no glass attachments on the plane which might have caused reflection. 50 people in 3 planes saw the objects and wrote reports on them. And during past months, exhaustive checks have established that no balloons or planes were in the area. Here again, the objects are seen making their unexplained journey through space. Observers said they rotated and showed a slipstream. Well, what do you think?
Well, what do you think?